Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today, we open our show with national news from Public News Service, including updates from the impeachment hearings in Washington, D.C., the latest findings on vaping-related illnesses and deaths, and more. Then in local news, new details are emerging about a student's death that led San Diego State University to suspend 14 fraternities. A strike at Kaiser Healthcare has been postponed due to the death of the company's CEO. Now, if you're concerned about frequent power outages, a forum on generators as options to keep the lights on is coming up in Alpine, and we'll have details. Then we'll have a special report on Supervisor Diane Jacobs' recent town hall in Julian, where concerns about fire protection and power outages topped the list of concerns, while a wildfire raged in nearby Ramona during the anniversary of our region's worst firestorms. West Nile virus has been found in a hawk in Ramona. Find out how to protect yourself on today's show. County supervisors have approved satellite voting locations, and the California Public Utilities Commission has launched an investigation into utilities shutting off power to prevent their lines from sparking fires. Our newsmaker interview today is with Craig Reed. He's the founder of Envision La Mesa, an organization that has been successful in making positive changes in West La Mesa. From Public News Service, we'll have a report on how a lack of enough teachers and other adults is impacting students in California schools. On Green Scene, learn about microgrids as options to power communities. We'll also have a report on Mercy Air's 30th anniversary of saving lives on People Power, plus we have a health alert about a recall on frozen berries. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Friday, November 15th, 2019.
Pundits are picking apart testimony from Wednesday's impeachment hearing as the inquiry into President Trump's dealings with Ukraine moves forward. At the first public impeachment hearing in 20 years, the senior U.S. diplomat in Ukraine, Bill Taylor, and a senior State Department official overseeing Ukraine policy, George Kent, testified. Taylor provided new evidence, stating that his staffer had overheard Trump asking the U.S. ambassador to the European Union about the investigations in a July phone call. However, Republicans pressed both witnesses about their lack of direct contact with Trump. The Trump campaign issued a statement dismissing the testimony as third-hand hearsay and ridiculing Kent and Taylor as unelected career government bureaucrats who think they know best.
In the ongoing impeachment saga, the sole witness before the House today is Marie Yovanovitch, the Ukraine ambassador removed from her post in May. Some Democratic lawmakers called her removal a political hit job.
A new report underscores the financial struggles plaguing college students after graduation, finding that nearly 25% of federal student loan borrowers default within 5 years of starting the repayment process.
Most of these borrowers showed signs of financial distress almost immediately when it came time to start repaying their student loan debt. Sarah Saddlemeyer manages the Pew Charitable Trust's Project on Student Borrower Success. She says the student loan system is outdated, confusingly complex, and often undermines borrowers' efforts to repay their debt.
Before they even enter repayment, some groups are more likely to struggle. For example, those who owe the least, and often less than $10,000, default at higher rates than those with higher balances.
The U.S. Department of Education reports that currently about 20% of student loan borrowers, that's more than 1 million people, are in default, and millions more are behind on their payments. I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
President Trump is appealing to the Supreme Court to have his tax returns shielded from New York prosecutors. Trump and his lawyers argue he's immune from criminal investigation while in office, setting up a potential showdown in the highest court in the land over the separation of powers. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals previously dismissed the president's arguments concerning a New York grand jury subpoena of Trump's accounting firm for his past 8 years of returns.
Amid the continued debate over curbing the climate crisis, A new report examines the role of agriculture both as a source of greenhouse gas emissions and a political solution to capturing carbon. According to the findings from the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, the farming sector has increased its greenhouse gas emissions over the past few decades. And it says improved soil health and resource conservation practices can reduce or even neutralize farming's carbon footprint. Emily Lipstrew with the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association cautions that inaction will result in devastating consequences for people, agriculture, and the environment.
The climate crisis is a serious threat to our food security, the viability of farmers and ranchers, and our environment. Action on the recommendations in this report will facilitate the shift to a more sustainable agriculture system to address this challenge head on.
The report puts forward nearly 30 detailed public policy recommendations.
In the healthcare debate, one medical professional says there should be more discussion about nutrition.
Democratic candidates running for president in 2020 have multiple ideas about how to fix the nation's healthcare system. But one cardiologist says they should also be addressing what's making people sick. Tufts University cardiologist Darius Mozafarian says 50 years ago, when the population was exploding, the goal was to reduce hunger. So food was designed to contain as many calories as possible. For most people today, hunger is no longer an issue. But he says many continue to eat in quantities that lead to diabetes, heart disease, and obesity.
I would like to see the Democratic candidates have a platform around food. It's the number one cause of poor health. It's the number one issue for sustainability. You know, we have childhood obesity, a huge issue for the economy, and nobody's talking about it.
Mozafarian says if the nation wants to reduce disease and its costs, meaningful health care reform is critical and should be a nonpartisan priority.
That was Roz Brown reporting.
Trade negotiations between the U.S. and China are running into trouble as the two countries attempt to finalize a limited trade agreement. According to reports, the U.S. is trying to secure stronger concessions from China to regulate intellectual property protections and to stop the practice of forced technology transfer in exchange for rolling back on some of the tariffs. However, China is reportedly apprehensive about committing to a specific amount of agricultural products in the deal. In the wake of recent reports of fatal lung illnesses connected with the use of e-cigarettes, new research seems to confirm concerns about the health impacts of vaping.
A study by Boston University researchers found that e-cigarettes altered cholesterol levels, and Dr. Florian Roder with the Schmidt Heart Institute at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles says his group's research suggests that vaping may be more harmful to heart health than traditional cigarettes.
Our study adds to the evidence that e-cigarette smoking may not be quite as healthy as it's being portrayed, and I think this is reason enough for now to be at least cautious.
Roder compared the blood flow of 10 non-smokers, 10 tobacco cigarette smokers, and 10 e-cigarette users. Testing blood flows at rest and while squeezing a hand grip, only e-cigarette users showed signs of coronary vascular dysfunction even when they were not exerting themselves physically. Industry groups have previously argued that vaping is a healthy alternative to traditional cigarettes, especially for people trying to kick their smoking habit. I'm Eric Galatis.
Facebook says it removed 3.2 billion fake accounts between April and September this year, along with millions of posts depicting child abuse and suicide. That's more than double the number of fake accounts taken down during the same period last year. There are concerns from law enforcement that Facebook's plans to provide greater privacy to users by encrypting the company's messaging services will hamper efforts to fight child abuse. I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service, member and listener supported. And online at publicnewsservice.org.
San Diego State University has suspended all activities by 14 fraternities following the death of a student, which has also prompted a police investigation. 19-year-old Dylan Hernandez attended a fraternity party and fell out of the bunk bed in his dorm room during the night. His roommate helped him back into the upper bunk, but found Hernandez without a pulse and not breathing the next day. He was taken to Alvarado Hospital and declared dead on November 8th. The medical examiner found cause of death to be blunt force trauma to his head. It is not yet known if alcohol played a role in his death. San Diego State's president, Adela De La Torre, announced that the university has suspended all activities by the 14 fraternities that make up its interfraternity council. The suspension does not affect the National Panhellenic Council, the College Panhellenic Association, the United Sorority and Fraternity Council, or the chapters affiliated with those organizations. De La Torre has also announced formation of two presidential task forces, one on student activities and safety, the other focused on alcohol and substance misuse. Hernandez, who is from Florida, had been pledging with the Phi Gamma Delta fraternity, also known as Fiji, according to the Daily Aztec. That same fraternity was placed on probation in 2017, after being found in violation of regulations pertaining to alcohol at off-campus fraternity events, the student newspaper reported. The fraternity is once again being investigated for possible misconduct on the night Hernandez attended the fraternity event. Six Interfraternity Council, or IFC-affiliated organizations, were under suspension and four others under investigation before President De La Torre's November 8th decision to suspend all 14 IFC-affiliated chapters. A friend of the Hernandez family created a fundraising campaign on GoFundMe Monday to support the family following their tragic loss. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
A strike planned by Kaiser mental health care workers has been postponed due to the unexpected death of Kaiser Permanente's CEO, Bernard Tyson, who died unexpectedly in his sleep on November 10th. The next day, 170 National Union of Healthcare Workers voted unanimously to postpone their planned five-day strike, which was slated to start November 11th, at 100 Kaiser clinics and medical facilities, including in San Diego. The strike was to have included about 4,000 Kaiser psychologists, therapists, and other mental health service providers. Sal Rosselli, president of the National Union of Healthcare Workers, says a new date for the strike has not yet been set. But he adds, "Our members dedicate their lives to helping people through tragedy and trauma, and they understand that a strike would not be appropriate during this period of mourning and reflection. We agree that this week should be for remembering Bernard Tyson and honoring his legacy." However, Rosselli said the union remains ready to resume negotiations with Kaiser to improve access to mental health care and boost retention and recruitment of clinicians who are seeking the same retirement and health benefits that Kaiser has contracted to provide to 140 other thousand employees. Kaiser's board of directors has named Gregory Adams, the executive vice president, as interim chairman and CEO. A statement from Kaiser remembers Tyson as an outstanding leader, visionary, and champion for high-quality, affordable health care for all Americans. A native of the San Francisco Bay Area, Tyson earned an MBA in Health Service Administration from Golden Gate University and later a leadership certificate from Harvard. He has been CEO of Kaiser since 2013 and chairman of the board of directors since 2014. His career there spanned over 30 years, where his roles ranged from hospital administrator to chief operating officer. Under his leadership, Kaiser grew from 9.1 million to 12.3 million members, with revenues rising from $53 billion to over $82 billion. The workforce also grew from 174,000 to 218,000 employees. Tyson's influence was felt both nationally and internationally. Time included him on its list of the most influential people in the world and named him one of the healthcare top 50. He was named by Modern Healthcare as one of the most influential people in healthcare for five consecutive years. Tyson served on the board of directors for the American Heart Association and was a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He also served as deputy chairman of the Americas of the International Federation of Health Plans, was former chair of American Health Insurance Plans, and a steward of the World Economic Forum's Global Challenge on the Future of Health and Healthcare. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
SDG&E has repeatedly shut off power to rural and mountain communities during high winds to prevent lines from sparking fires. That has fueled demand for generators to keep not only lights on, but critical items such as water well pumps, refrigerators, and medical equipment. Another option is a solar power system with battery backup to provide power during outages. Which system is best for your household, and what do you need to know before making a decision? The Alpine Library will host a forum on Tuesday, November 19th at 5:30 p.m., where you can learn more about generators, solar battery backup, and other residential emergency power options. SDG&E will be on hand to answer questions, along with Camps Propane and Global Power representatives. Again, that forum will be held Tuesday, November 19th at 5:30 p.m. in the Alpine branch of the San Diego County Library System. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
Supervisor Diane Jacob ventured into a potential firestorm when she held a town hall forum at Julian Town Hall on October 25th, the anniversary week of the devastating 2003 Cedar Fire and 2007 Witch Creek firestorm. With power shut off by SDG&E to much of the mountain region to prevent fires, amid Santa Ana winds, fire safety and power outages topped residents' lists of concerns. Ironically, moments before the town hall began, a brush fire erupted near Witch Creek between Ramona and Julian. Throughout the meeting, Jacob, along with East County Magazine's editor Miriam Raftery, who operates the East County Wildfire and Emergency Alerts, updated the town hall audience on the progress of the Sade Fire in Ramona, which spread to 97 acres and shut down Highway 78 for several hours. Several residents left the meeting as the fire threatened homes and forced evacuations. Supervisor Jacob opened the meeting by acknowledging, "We are all on edge." Jacob, who chairs the county's United Fire Council, outlined major investments made by the county to improve fire safety and stated, "But we are better prepared than ever before." That contention, however, was disputed by the president of the board of the former Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District, as multiple fire engines and an ambulance roared past the town hall toward Ramona to fight the Sade Fire. The county recently dissolved the Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District, San Diego County's last volunteer fire department, moving fire and medical services under the control of the county fire authority. Although the change was approved by a narrow majority of residents through a ballot initiative and is being challenged in a lawsuit, the action sparked controversy and concerns among many who warned that the change would leave Julian with less fire protection if CAL FIRE crews were dispatched to fight a wildland fire elsewhere. Jacob noted that the county has invested millions in upgrading fire services, including conducting controlled burns, cutting fire breaks, and contracting for DC-10 aircraft to help fight fires. But she acknowledged that the dry weather forecast into December is historic and told residents, "Pray that we get some rain." She criticized SDG&E for shutting off power to limit its liability by preventing lines from sparking fires, noting that those actions put some ratepayers at risk. Jacob said 2/3 of East County residents depend on wells for drinking water. When power is off, electric well pumps don't work, so there is no water for residents to drink or for fighting fires. One way to mitigate the risk of public safety electricity shutoffs would be for SDG&E to provide portable generators, but Jacob noted it's all about the money. SDG&E was responsible for 3 of the big firestorms, according to state regulators. The utility is changing out wood poles to steel and widening spaces on lines, but a report by the company indicates that won't be finished until 2027. Jacob called that timetable irresponsible. She also questioned why ratepayers should have to pay for a new fire fee on their bills. Even Jacob acknowledged that SDG&E has done more than PG&E, which infamously cut power to millions in Northern California. An SDG&E spokesman says the company has buried 60% of its lines, roughly 10,000 miles of wiring, underground, and plans to bury more, though in some places rugged terrain prevents undergrounding lines. The company has also installed cameras and weather monitors across the backcountry. In fact, it was SDG&E's equipment that first detected the Sade Fire and alerted fire authorities. The company also has its own firefighting team, including an air crane, to combat fires. Eugene Mitch Mitchell, Vice President of External Affairs for SDG&E, told the Julian audience that the 2007 firestorms were a rude awakening, which prompted the company to study fire science and begin designing lines to withstand winds up to 100 miles per hour. But he noted, when the winds blow at 85 miles per hour, the brush, tumbleweeds, blow into the lines. It's not just the lines which are the problem, it's what's around them. Mitchell says SDG&E is trying to get state funds for a wire-down strategy that would shut off power if a wire breaks. Jacob said she would ask the state to waive environmental rules to help make this happen. Residents peppered SDG&E with questions, including requests for generators for areas repeatedly losing power. A suggestion was also made to build a microgrid for Julian to keep power on during SDG&E outages, as Borrego Springs already has done. Tensions mounted when Mike Mangini, president of the board for the former Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District, stood up and spoke over the wail of sirens heading toward the Sade Fire some 35 miles away. Mangini told Supervisor Jacob, "Cal Fire's equipment is all down the hill to fight the fire. If a house fire starts in Julian, we're sunk." He added, "We're ready, and we're closed to everybody," a reference to the fact that before the county pushed to dissolve the Volunteer Fire Department, volunteer firefighters were available to respond to fires, either as first responders or as backup when Cal Fire was dispatched elsewhere. Mangini told Jacob, "The county should reconsider what it's doing to us. I feel way less protected than I did before," drawing loud applause from the audience. No one disputed his statement that Julian was left without firefighting resources during the Sade Fire. Our contributing editor, Paul Cruz, took several photos out the town hall window of equipment racing to Ramona. Our editor later emailed Cal Fire's public information officer, Isaac Sanchez, to ask what steps will be taken to prevent Julian from being left bare of firefighting resources in future wildland fires, but he has not responded. At the town hall, Jacob praised the former volunteer firefighters and the dissolved agency's paramedics as unsung heroes. She reminded the audience that she had supported the future of the fire department going to a vote. Mangini called the vote that dissolved the district a farce. He and others have contended that the ballot measure's wording was confusing, and they have objected to the vote being done entirely by mail, with no polling place in Julian for the election. Our editor, Miriam Raftery, told Supervisor Jacob that there are anecdotal complaints from some residents of long response times since the transition to county control. She asked about records for response times for all incidents since the takeover to determine if response times are better, worse, or the same. Jacob replied, "Facts are good," and said she'd be happy to look at response times, but did not offer to track down those records. She said Julian is getting an extra $1.5 million of county money annually for year-round staffing and a paramedic engine, adding that the court will ultimately decide the future of the fire department. But that small consolation to Julian residents left bare of firefighting and medical response teams as a wildfire raged in a nearby town amid high winds and power outages. On other issues, Jacob told her constituents in Julian about changes recently approved by supervisors to make it easier to build accessory dwelling units or granny flats. She praised supervisors' recent vote to approve a community choice energy alternative. She also fielded questions on issues such as a need for more visitor parking and increased sewer capacity, and asked residents to bring her specific proposals. Our contributing editor, Paul Cruz, asked about the denial of county funds for Julian's 4th of July parade. Jacob promised, "We're going to take care of that," drawing applause. She also invited everyone to the grand opening of the new Santa Isabel Nature Center on December 14th, the only nature center in East County, ending the meeting on a positive note. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health alert. County environmental health officials have announced that a dead Cooper's hawk found in Ramona has tested positive for West Nile virus. This is the second case of West Nile found in birds locally this year. In March, another dead Cooper's hawk found in Lakeside also carried the virus. No locally transmitted cases have been identified yet this year in humans, although two people did test positive for the virus locally after contracting it in other counties. Symptoms of West Nile can include headache, fever, nausea, skin rash, or swollen glands. And while most people recover and some show no symptoms, in about 1 in every 150 cases, the disease can cause serious illness, including brain swelling or even death. County vector control officials are warning residents to protect against mosquitoes which carry the virus and can transmit it to humans or animals through bites. Dump out standing water daily from items such as buckets and plant saucers to eliminate potential mosquito breeding areas. Mosquito fish are available free to residents who have ponds or other standing water sources. You can wear long sleeves and pants when outside, or use insect repellent containing picaridin or oil of lemon eucalyptus to protect yourself from mosquitoes. do not handle dead birds. Instead, report them, as well as mosquito activity, to Vector Control at 858-694-2888. And for more information on West Nile virus, you can Google the San Diego County's Fight the Bite website.
County supervisors have approved funding for 4 satellite voting locations for the March 2020 primary election. Traditional polling places will remain in place, but the satellite voting locations will act as offshoots of the registrar's office. They will open 3 days before Election Day and be staffed by registrar employees. Potential locations for the 4 satellite sites are in San Marcos, Carmel Mountain Ranch, Spring Valley, and Chula Vista. The move came after passage of State Senate Bill 72, which requires the registrar to allow conditional voter registration at every polling place starting with the March 3rd election. That means that anyone who wants to register to vote, re-register to vote after an address change, or change their party preference to vote for a presidential candidate, can do so on Election Day. During the last election, conditional voter registration was allowed only at the registrar's office, creating long waits for people. To avoid long lines at the polls at the registrar's office in March, conditional voter registration voters have the option to visit one of the satellite voting locations. Registrar staff will have electronic access to the voter rolls to process registrations quickly and give the voters their ballots. Those who go to the polls on Election Day to register and vote, by contrast, will have to vote provisionally. Provisional ballots take longer to process because registrar staff must check whether the voters are registered, if they are eligible to vote in the races they marked on their ballots, and to be sure they did not vote twice. Registrar of Voters Michael Vu says that now is the time to register. Check your registration, or re-register if you need to. Don't wait until Election Day unless you absolutely must. Also, understand the rules for voting in party primaries. The Republican Party requires that a voter be registered in that party in order to vote in the Republican primary. While the Democratic Party does not require registration as a Democrat to vote in their party's primary, voters who decline to state party affiliation on their registration form must request a Democratic ballot in advance if they are voting by mail. For more information on voting rules for these or other parties, check with the Registrar of Voters at www.sdvote.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
The California Public Utilities Commission has opened an investigation into recent public safety power shutoffs to ensure that utilities are held accountable for their actions. The electric utilities under investigation include San Diego Gas and Electric Company, or SDG&E locally, as well as Pacific Gas and Electric Company, or PG&E, Southern California Edison, and other companies that de-energized power lines during high winds and dry conditions recently to reduce the risk of utility infrastructure starting wildfires. The formal investigation will assess whether the state's investor-owned utilities properly balance the need to provide safe and reliable service against impacts on ratepayers. The widespread outages prompted many complaints from ratepayers who suffered inconveniences, financial losses, and vulnerability to potential harm due to the power outages. Results of the investigation will be presented in a public report, which could lead to changes in regulations regarding power outages to assure safety, as well as potential enforcement actions if utilities violated any existing regulations. PUC Commissioner Genevieve Sharoma says it is important for the CPUC to determine if the utilities complied with using public safety power shutoffs as a last resort and to collect the knowledge gained toward any revisions needed for next year. And she adds, "It is essential that our protocols and the utilities' practices provide the best service and protections for customers in the face of wildfires." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the mountains to the sea.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. It's very often in today's times that citizens may feel that their voice doesn't matter, that they don't have any power, that government doesn't listen to them. But sometimes it does. And today we are here with Craig Reed from Envision La Mesa, an organization that he helped start with help from other citizens in the area, and they have made a positive difference in their community, and you're going to hear how on today's show. Craig, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Can you start by telling me about how Envision La Mesa got started?
Well, we started actually on Nextdoor. It was actually a series of incidents on the west side. We would start seeing those illegal dispensaries during that time frame around 2016 that were popping up and being shut down, but nonetheless leaving blight in their wake and taking the neighborhood in the wrong direction, we felt.
Yeah, the illegal pot shops, it's been like whack-a-mole where the police will shut one down and it seems like the next day you've got others opening up. So it's been kind of a constant battle in the city. And Nextdoor, for those who may not be familiar, is an online discussion forum. It's great. I'm on one here in the Mount Helix area, and I know we solve, you know, all the neighborhood problems right there, it seems like, sometimes, or at least get a forum for discussing them.
Yeah, very true.
So when you realized there was a problem with these marijuana dispensaries, the illegal ones, being shut down and leaving all kinds of blight, you know, vandalism, trash, and so forth, what did you do about it?
Well, at first, it was mostly commenting on Nextdoor activities that had been reported. And at some point, though, a number of us started going, well, how about we take some action ourselves? Let's see what we can do to make the place on the west side better.
And can we define, by the way, how you define La Mesa's west side? What are the boundaries?
For our purposes, we look at La Mesa Boulevard as the eastern part of our boundary, and then kind of following El Cajon Boulevard and University Avenue all the way to the city border with the city of San Diego.
Okay, very good. So what did the citizens do?
So we started meeting. First, it was at coffee shops, and it was a small gathering, sometimes at somebody's house, trying to wrestle with that idea of what can we do and what do we want to do? Because we both have to have the means and the passion to take steps forward. And finally, we started realizing that we needed to get a handle on what the situation was, which is where we started our environmental scans.
So tell me about the environmental scans. What were those all about?
So the environmental scans are a snapshot of things that are either blight-related or can easily lead to blight. So in our case, abandoned buildings or ones that seemingly look abandoned, empty storefronts, broken windows, signs that are damaged, those are all blight-related issues.
So I understand from hearing you speak at the city council meeting a couple of weeks ago that you actually got a group together and you guys went out literally door to door or walking past every single property, taking notes and doing a report for the city on what properties appeared blighted and that might, you know, dissuade, say, people passing through La Mesa from wanting to stop at those businesses, stores, and restaurants, and so forth.
Yes. So one of the things that we thought about was that the environmental scan are all those social cues that help us decide as whether we're driving or walking down a street, whether to stop and explore those shops that are along the side of the road or just to keep going until we feel safe and have a more welcoming environment.
Yeah.
And so by the time we presented at the city council a few weeks back, that was after 2 years worth of data. So we could not, we didn't just have a snapshot. We had trend lines that were starting to form thanks
Very
to two
good.
Years.
Very good. And so how was this received when you went before the council, or for that matter, the city staff, if you talked to them first?
Yeah, we talked to our city manager as well as to the mayor and city council members and started showcasing bits and pieces of the data as we were analyzing it. And it was well received. They were surprised, because one of the things about the environmental scan is we're not looking for everything. We're looking for what can you see from the sidewalk.
Interesting.
And so it's getting that streetscape, because once again, we're not concerned about every bit of trash or every broken window, but what can you see from the street that says this is a safe and welcoming environment or this is not, and keep moving.
Yeah. Now, you also did some trash cleanup on your own. Tell me, how much trash your group picked up?
Well, we can't take all the credit, because there were a tremendous number of Helix High School students that were present, the latest one.
Yay, Scotty's my alma mater.
We love having them next door to us, and as well as I Love a Clean San Diego, and I think even some people from La Mesa Conversations were there as well.
Yeah.
So in total, there's just over 500 pounds of trash and recyclables that were collected that day.
That's a quarter of a ton. That's a lot of trash.
Yes, and that was just one small segment of university. It was not even the whole area of Westside that we worked on.
Very good. So you came to the council saying, obviously, we need to do more than just have a bunch of individuals pick up trash. That's great, but there's graffiti and broken windows and doors that have been, you know, knocked in and so forth. Landscaping, you know, that's not up to snuff. So what proposals did you make to the council, and what were their ideas for how to solve this in a bigger picture?
Well, we can't take credit for all the ideas, because it was really us talking with city council and with other constituents to find out what should we be trying. I mean, this is not going to solve itself as is. We need to try a few things. And that's where the micro grants, for example, came up. This is, if it goes as planned, which right now it's at, I think the city staff are designing it right now, mm-hmm. It will allow for local businesses to get a small grant to help with paint, restoring a sign, perhaps, power washing, all those little things that make it a cleaner, nicer place.
Landscaping, outdoor art, I think all those things were on the list.
And
the council actually voted to approve this in concept. They asked staff to draft it up. And they not only voted to approve it, you know, they all said we need a way to fund it. And so three of the council members came forward and said, we'll give up our expense money, you know, that were expense reimbursement to fund these little micro grants. And let's give credit where credit is due. The three who agreed to give up their expense money to clean up blighted West La Mesa were Councilwoman Christina Licio, who suggested that, Councilwoman Akilah Weber, and Councilman Bill Baber. So kudos to those three for that. In addition, there's a broader grant program. Those are micro grants as part of a pilot program, small grants. But the city also approved in concept larger grants. And what's interesting is these are going to be funded through revenues from a newly approved ordinance that will legalize recreational marijuana businesses, including dispensaries and manufacturing and cultivation and so forth. And the idea was that this will hopefully drive away the illegal ones, so they won't keep popping up if they've got competition from legally licensed businesses. And the revenues from those new legal marijuana businesses, cannabis businesses, would be used to fund cleaning up blight in the properties that adjoin or surround the former illegal pot shops. So what do you think about that idea?
We're really excited that this idea came out of our conversations with the city council members. As many people drive by El Cajon Boulevard around the parks, I believe, is where one of the illegal dispensaries, a former one that was shut down, and they've been struggling to do something with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then other sites that have successfully sold, it took 6 or 7 times falling out of escrow before they were finally sold, as we found out.
Interesting. So, we should note that nobody who owned an illegal dispensary can get this grant money. It's for their neighbors, or if the property sells and they meet certain requirements, they can't be a relative or somebody with a criminal background or something. But if it's an all-new, unrelated owner with a clean background, then they can also apply for a grant to clean up the blighted, former cannabis dispensary site as well, I understand.
Yes, and we're really excited about that, that it gives a bit of incentive for anybody to consider the West Side as a place to start their business.
Yeah. Now, dealing with the blight is not the only thing that your group has been doing, I understand. Tell me a little bit about your Hidden Gems program that Envision La Mesa is doing.
So Envision La Mesa works on what's called Hidden Gems, and what it is, it's a program or kind of a social event that highlights the restaurants that have been on the West Side for a number of years. So those that are kind of known by the vets and long-term residents of the West Side, but are not really well known by millennials and other people who have newly moved in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a way to create a social event around that restaurant to highlight their food as an opportunity for the owner to come out and say hi and tell a little bit of their history to us.
Very cool. Because so often, as the clientele ages for some of these wonderful restaurants, not just in La Mesa, of course, but everywhere, we see some of the old favorites close because the younger generation hasn't discovered them. So that's kind of cool. What are some of the restaurants out there that you've highlighted so far?
Well, one of the first ones was J.K. Greek's. It's on University Avenue and has a nice little storefront, as well as BMH Deli, which we had probably our largest event was there. And that one's on El Cajon Boulevard, mm-hmm. and just a wonderful stop that if you want an alternative to, like, say, Subway or something, it's a great place to try.
Locally owned business.
Locally owned business, yeah. Exactly.
And then the coffee shop over there, the Space Bar Internet Cafe.
Space Bar, we will be planning that one shortly. We are looking forward to them hosting our next Hidden Gems.
Now, there's also, I understand, some signs of new life over there recently. You've got some new businesses that have moved into West La Mesa.
Yes, one of the ones people might be familiar with is Bolt Brewing, which, as we know, in the industrial area, they have a site there where they just opened up on the west side as well. So
very exciting.
It's a little more walkable, and we're glad to have them there. As well as Birkenstocks from Lemon Grove is moving over, too.
And old hippie shoes come to La Mesa, huh?
Well, and they've taken over the old aquarium storefront, which, considering how large of storefront that was, it's a little more challenging to find somebody to take that over. So we're really glad to see them come and join us.
Very interesting. So now we know where we can find comfy walking shoes to walk around the newly fixed up West La Mesa neighborhood. Fun. Yeah. Where can people get more information about Envision La Mesa if they want to get involved, join, volunteer, or just, follow those hidden gems?
Well, the best way is to follow us on Facebook. So just simply type in Envision La Mesa.
That's Envision.
Correct.
Envision La Mesa. Okay. Yeah. I understand you also hold monthly meetings. Tell us about that.
Yes, once a month on the first Tuesday, we meet in the community room at the La Mesa Police Department, and that's where all the action happens, and we'd love to see people show up and learn about us as well as participate.
And what time is the first Tuesday meeting?
It's at 7 o'clock.
Very good. It's really exciting to see so much activity and new life coming into West La Mesa. We've seen what happened with La Mesa's downtown village. It wasn't too long ago that it was a little bit run down, but it's gotten all fixed up now. It's like a new dynamic restaurant row for East County if people haven't been down there in a while. It's really changed. New streetscapes. The city put some money into that also. Looking ahead in your crystal ball there, what do you foresee happening in West La Mesa if we were to look ahead 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the road, Craig?
Well, we're hoping to see that our West Side neighborhood gradually improves over time. I mean, we are known as the Jewel of the Hill, and I'm hoping that we can be one of those shining gem examples, if you will, of what it means to live in La Mesa and a place that you love to live and shop in.
Very good. Well, La Mesa is my hometown. It's very exciting to see all of this happening. So thank you so much for all that your group is doing. And listeners, if you just tuned in, we have been speaking with Craig Reed, who is the founder and driving force behind Envision La Mesa, a citizens group that has been working hard to clean up and improve the West La Mesa community. Craig, thanks so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
California schools have far too few teachers and other adults on campus in K-12, and the kids' education is suffering, according to a new report from the nonprofit group Children Now. Researchers compared a typical high school, Gunderson High in San Jose, with similar schools in two other states and found the student-teacher ratio is 30 to 1 here, but 20 to 1 in Illinois and 11 to 1 in New Jersey. Terrell Burdett, a first-grade teacher from Lancaster, says California teachers are overwhelmed.
Now some of our schools have 33 first graders and no instructional aid. We have no planning time, zero, you know, so any planning we do is on our own time.
The report found that California spends about $11,000 a year per pupil, whereas Illinois and New Jersey spend $3,000 and $6,000 more per student, respectively. The difference? Schools in better-funded states have more instructional aides, librarians, counselors, coaches, music, arts, and technology teachers, and extracurricular programs. Burdett says huge numbers of California teachers will be retiring in the next few years, and the underfunding will make it hard to recruit and keep their replacements.
If they get in and they're not getting supported, it will be a rough go getting enough teachers into the classroom. A little help would go a long way towards keeping teachers in the profession.
California has slowly restored most of the cuts made during the recession, but even at pre-recession levels, California lags far behind other states in educational funding. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. Energy microgrids, which can power businesses, neighborhoods, or even entire cities, are being touted as alternative ways to keep the lights on when California's big utility companies shut power to avert wildfires, CalMatters reports. Over a million Californians were left in the dark for days recently as big utility companies shut off power for fear of sparking wildfires. Frustrated by those outages, some homeowners are seeking alternatives to keep the lights on. The mayors of San Francisco and San Jose say they want to sever ties with Pacific Gas and Electric, or PG&E, which serves much of Northern California, and create separate utilities for their cities. Searching for solutions, one idea is to join microgrids, or set up banks of generators to keep electricity flowing during widespread power cutoffs. A microgrid can be as simple as a single home operating on its own solar power, or a complex series of connections between a power source and distribution lines to end users. It can run a business, a neighborhood, or an entire city. It can be any size and may be fueled by either renewable energy stored in batteries or by generators run on a conventional fuel such as diesel. Borrego Springs is a local example of a city with a microgrid that powers the desert community. That town and others like it are known as end-of-the-line communities lying just beyond the reach of power companies' distribution lines. For those small locales and for residents in many rural parts of California, a microgrid is the only choice if they want power. Many state universities have training wheel versions that use small solar arrays to power a building or part of a campus. UC San Diego runs a much larger system that provides up to 90% of campus electricity. If some California lawmakers have their way, there will soon be many more such systems. A bill in the legislature would require utility companies to identify the state's best areas for microgrids and then build them. A 2018 law sets a deadline of December 1, 2020, just a year away, to create a program to operate microgrids, especially during emergencies. The State Public Utilities Commission, the California Energy Commission, and the Independent System Operator, which runs most of the state's electrical grid, are developing the plan. Former Governor Jerry Brown is an enthusiastic supporter of microgrids. He said in his 2015 inaugural address that they should be greatly expanded. His rural retirement compound, Rancho Venada, at the end of a dusty road in Colusa County, is powered by a microgrid system. Natural disasters have a way of prying open windows of opportunity, but California is behind the curve. Could the fires be our Superstorm Sandy, bringing about change? Hurricane Sandy lashed the East Coast in 2012, leaving millions of customers in 21 states without power for days or even weeks. The superstorm brought about policy changes in several Northeast states. Connecticut became first in the U.S. to create a statewide system of microgrids to provide emergency power. A microgrid research project at a Japanese university kept operating after a magnitude 9.1 earthquake, and a tsunami devastated Japan in 2011, knocking out power. That woke up policymakers. The genie was out of the bottle, so to speak. In the last few years, resilience has become the watchword for the advantages of microgrids. During the 2017 fires in Sonoma County, Stone Edge Farm drew electricity from its microgrids for 10 days while power was down from utilities. State officials hope that eventually electricity generated by microgrids can keep critical services operating during emergencies at hospitals, communication systems, community centers, and more. Fremont, California has already outfitted 3 fire stations of its own with power supplies. Besides microgrids, many homeowners and small businesses use their own generators powered by diesel fuel, natural gas, or propane during outages. They work well, but have limitations. Diesel motors can be loud, and they can't be operated indoors because of dangerous fumes. Fuel for generators must be stored nearby, and that fuel is highly flammable, and usually based on fossil fuels. Many residential solar systems now include batteries to store energy from rooftop panels. During a blackout, these systems allow homeowners to just flip a switch and use their own stored power to keep the lights on. If used sparingly, running only critical appliances and devices, such storage systems can provide 5 or 10 hours of power. The batteries can replenish themselves during the day, so homeowners may be protected even in a prolonged outage. The systems are popular, as are solar-powered generators, all being heavily marketed as fires burn across the state. Susanna Churchill, the CEO of California Vote Solar, says people can power their refrigerators or computers, providing resilience during extended power outages. She adds that these systems can be critical for people who are dependent on electricity to operate at-home medical equipment, saving lives. A poke in the eye to big companies and their power cutoffs may provide momentary satisfaction and give customers some sense of control, but it won't solve the blackout problem long term. Most of us, after all, are connected to the grid and to the big utilities that have spent 100 years building it. The rise of small, locally run utilities known as community choice provides alternatives to big, for-profit utilities. Most of these entities use power that comes from clean energy. Many cities and counties have already gone this route, supplying power to 2.5 million customers in California last year. San Diego County and several local cities, including La Mesa in East County, have recently voted to adopt community choice programs. But even community choice programs rely on infrastructure owned by the big utilities, since they're plugged into the utilities' wires and poles. When PG&E recently shut off power to residents in Sonoma County for fear its equipment could start a fire, Sonoma Clean Power, a community choice utility, was unable to provide power, leaving its customers in the dark. At least one community choice utility, however, Peninsula Clean Energy up in San Mateo County, recently announced a $10 million investment in emergency backup power systems to keep electricity flowing to its customers even when PG&E shuts off power. CEO Jan Pepper told Californians Aware, Peninsula Clean Energy is concerned about residents for whom power shutoffs could be life-threatening, for example, those who rely on respirators. The idea is to keep them in their homes where they are comfortable with clean battery backup that can keep their essential medical equipment functioning. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is Rebecca Williamson with the People Power Report. Laura Elliott and Russell Haight work in a fly-in emergency room run by Mercy Air, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary as an air ambulance provider working out of Gillespie Field in El Cajon and other locations in California, Nevada, and Arizona. Flying in stormy weather and dodging power lines while landing on rough terrain are all just a part of the job. Elliott, the local base lead and flight paramedic, said in an interview with East County Magazine, "We've landed in intersections, cul-de-sacs, trails, and even a boat launch area at Barrett Lake. They've helped rescue patients during wildfires and other natural disasters. Last July, Mercy Air helped transfer patients out of a hospital damaged by the 7.1 Ridgecrest earthquake. Pilot Brent Bass airlifted a first responder out of a wildfire area. The team has even helped deliver babies. Last time we delivered a baby in a car was in Chula Vista at a high school," Elliott said. "Timely rescues are crucial in saving lives. The air ambulance acts as a link for survival offering advanced trauma care to specialty care, such as stroke or cardiac specialties. According to staff, Mercy Air is the only air ambulance provider in Southern California equipped and trained to independently transport cardiac patients on an intra-aortic balloon pump. Russell Haight, a registered nurse, says the helicopter flies through rain or shine, and the pilot checks weather and conditions before taking off. Elliot and Haight, along with the pilot, deal in life or death situations on a 24/7, 365 days a year basis. The helicopter is equipped with medical apparatus to fit all ages and sizes, as well as medicines and more. The team is also prepared to honor all religious beliefs and customs if a patient passes away, and always protects patients' privacy. Mercy Air was established in 1989 and later merged with other programs such as Life Flight San Diego. Since then, the company has expanded to a fleet of 23 helicopters and one fixed-wing aircraft, helping to save countless lives.
This is Gerald Stevenson with a health alert. Frozen raspberry products, recalled for possible hepatitis A contamination, were sold in 8 Aldi supermarkets in San Diego County, including the Aldi store on Navajo Road in San Carlos, here in East County. The contaminated berries were also in yogurt parfaits served at cafeterias in the Escondido Union School District, the County Health and Human Services Agency has announced. There have been no illnesses reported due to exposure to these products. A nationwide recall on frozen raspberries sold under the Aldi and Raley's Supermarket private label brands was posted by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration on October 31st due to possible contamination with the hepatitis A virus. The virus was detected in a routine sampling program conducted by the FDA, which led to the voluntary recall. People who have purchased the berries should not eat them and should return them to the store for a refund. The California Department of Public Health has published a full list of locations where the berries were sold or served. County Public Health Officer Dr. Wilma Wooten says anyone who has not had 2 hepatitis A vaccinations and ate the recalled frozen raspberry products or the yogurt parfaits made from them should talk to their health care provider about getting immunizations to prevent the illness. Everyone who ate these items should be aware of the symptoms of hepatitis A and seek medical attention early if they appear. Signs of hepatitis A can appear between 2 and 7 weeks after exposure. Symptoms include mild fever, loss of appetite, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, fatigue, pain in the upper right side of the abdomen, dark urine, and jaundice or yellow eyes or skin. It is important that if you have these symptoms, you seek medical attention and do not work in food service, health care, or child care until you are no longer infectious. The hepatitis A vaccine or immune globulin can prevent infection if given within 14 days of exposure. The vaccine is available from healthcare providers and at county public health centers. The vaccine has been recommended for children since 1999, so children who have already been vaccinated should be protected. The recall products sold at Aldi include Season's Choice Raspberries and Season's Choice Berry Medley, both frozen. Raley's Fresh Frozen Red Raspberries, sold at Raley's Supermarkets, were also recalled, but were not sold in San Diego County.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.